Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, August 11th, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. Points of Progress is AWOL, so I'll read Progress Watch. Science and Nature is AWOL, so I'll read the Explainer. And then the Home Forum and the Monitor's View. So getting right into it. The From the Editor column is entitled, The Promises and Drawbacks of U.S. Aid. This is written by Armin Sethna, who is an editorial writer. She has worked in international development for 20 years. You can email her at sethnaa@csmonitor.com. And she writes, In his inaugural address of January 1961, President John F. Kennedy famously appealed to Americans' sense of duty with his exhortation, Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Establishing the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, later that year, he, in effect, urged Americans to ask what they could do for their world, too. There is no escaping our obligations, moral, economic, and political, as part of the interdependent community of free nations, Mr. Kennedy said at the time. He hoped poor nations would rapidly transition into self-sustained growth and look toward the ultimate day when foreign aid would no longer be needed. Now, with the official shuttering of USAID, the flow of American development assistance has stopped. But the debate about its necessity and nature continues and remains contentious. In this week's pairing of cover stories, we hear from several USAID workers who are struggling not only with the loss of their jobs, but also with the idea that their country no longer sees value in providing international aid. There is serious and understandable concern about the abrupt halt to USAID's work earlier this year. Yet a reckoning over foreign aid's utility, effectiveness, and assumptions about change has been underway for some time. An increasing number of aid professionals and host country citizens are disquieted by the ongoing expectation of foreign aid. Some say that inappropriate external aid agendas and technologies have wasted resources, undermined local initiative and responsiveness, and fostered corruption. There is truth to this. However, it is also true that U.S. generosity over the decades has made a tangible difference to countless individuals and communities. For instance, in Kenya, a USAID-funded micro-lending project, which helped thousands of entrepreneurs, was transformed into a large-scale, locally-led, and viable commercial bank. In Zimbabwe, innovative community-based child protection strategies supported by USAID contractors filtered upward and were adopted as national government policy. And one source told our reporter Erica Page, if we as development professionals do a good job, we eventually put ourselves out of business. For the U.S. to learn from the limits or failures of some USAID projects, it is instructive to recall that the successes have built on respectful listening and genuine partnership. When the donor devolved decision-making, host communities and leaders set the priorities and committed to change. And so, for thousands around the world, from the American people, the words of USAID's motto has come to mean much more than financial inputs. It has signified vision, opportunity, endeavor, in short, founding American principles. Such has been the soft power of U.S. ideals and assistance. Today, amid the challenges posed by USAID's demise, there are seeds of promise and shifts in thought. It is worth repeating the concluding quote in a Monitor editorial from a few months ago in which a Kenyan community activist said, It is time to reimagine the new international model that serves communities with dignity and respect. And that was the From the Editor column this week written by Armin Sethna, who is an editorial writer. And it was entitled, The Promises and Drawbacks of U.S. Aid. Okay, our first of two cover stories is entitled, Is USAID Career Over? One worker wonders if he can still serve his country. An estimated 233,000 people, including 19,000 Americans, lost their jobs after the U.S. shuttered most of its global aid programs. This is written by Story Hinckley, and way down here they do have that paragraph entitled Why We Wrote This. It's got the heading of Transformation. After the Trump administration announced it was gutting the U.S. Agency for International Development, most workers got their final paychecks in July. The Monitor followed veteran aid workers as they tried to figure out their next steps. From Minneapolis, after rifling through a kitchen cabinet to find a hole punch, William Bradley sat down at his dining room table in Minneapolis with a cup of coffee and the diplomatic passport he's had for roughly two decades. As instructed, he punched two holes on the bottom. He took a picture of those holes with his cell phone, then he emailed the government proof that his career was over. It was at this table 5 months before that Mr. Bradley learned from a TV news report that he and most of his 10,000 colleagues at the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, were losing their jobs. During this time, he felt scared. He was 3 years away from retirement and the pension his family had been counting on, and he's felt guilty. When the news broke, Mr. Bradley had just finished onboarding 21 new USAID employees who had quit other jobs to serve America. So, for the past 5 months or so, he's been angry. One day, he walked out his front door, got into his Volkswagen camper van, and closed the door and screamed. Against his better judgment, he's been in denial during this time, waiting until the final day to pull out his hole punch and send proof his ID had been invalidated. A small part of him had hoped his government would realize at some point that it needed him. But July 1st was the official restructuring deadline, putting some USAID functions under the purview of the State Department while terminating the rest. It was also the last day on the payroll for USAID employees like Mr. Bradley. Now, after a liminal period of judicial restraining orders, reversals, and much waiting, thousands of USAID workers are having to begin a new chapter. For many, along with other federal workers fired at the hands of President Donald Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, that means figuring out a new career in a flooded job market. Some are considering running for political office. Others are suing the government they used to serve. Overall, at least 58,000 federal workers have been fired since President Trump took office in January, promising to dismantle government bureaucracy and hold a crooked and dishonest workforce to account. Another 76,000 have accepted buyouts. Few agencies, however, have received the kind of vitriol leveled at USAID. Mr. Trump has called USAID employees radical left lunatics who have stolen billions of dollars. Elon Musk, the world's richest man who headed DOGE's efforts for months, celebrated feeding USAID into the wood chipper while helping to cut more than 99% of the agency's staff. One challenge for many of these former employees is reconciling how they will see themselves as loyal Americans who have dedicated their lives to their nation with the derogatory statements from their president and his administration. Mr. Bradley has always considered himself a patriot, someone who serves his country. Now he looks to his family, sitting around the dining room table, with a pressing question. Should I run for Congress? No, says Hawa, his daughter, who just graduated from middle school. I think it's wiser to take a job, says his son, James, who will begin a PhD program in chemistry at the University of Minnesota this fall. But he's worried about the apartment lease he just signed, given the Trump administration's cuts to science funding. Why do you want to batter yourself again, asks his wife, Azarth Bradley. Your government should protect you, not hurt you. Over the 17 years he spent as an officer at USAID, Mr. Bradley's life was a series of assignments. Build latrines in Benin, help farmers amid war's wreckage in Afghanistan, oversee agriculture projects in Cambodia, Guinea, and Senegal. He sometimes worried that he was putting his family through too much for the sake of his job. He remembers watching his children get their temperature checked before school every morning when they were in Guinea during the Ebola crisis. He recalls how his wife was so upset to leave Minneapolis for Senegal a decade ago that when the movers arrived, nothing was packed. James was unhappy in Guinea after leaving all of his friends in Cambodia and chose to finish junior high at a boarding school in Minneapolis. Hawa can't decide what country is home after living in Minneapolis for 3 years and Senegal for five years before that. Mr. Bradley always knew that private sector jobs in the mining industry where he had started his career in Utah paid double what he made with USAID. But whenever he considered quitting government service, he thought about how he had made a difference in people's lives as a representative of the United States. And he knew that even though he was making a lower salary now, he would have a federal pension later. When he turned on his work computer so it could be remotely wiped by one of the few remaining USAID employees, he found himself reviewing some old documents, like one he had saved about the Foreign Service pension system. It confirmed the numbers he had already triple-checked on an Excel spreadsheet he'd made. In 3 years, on July 3, 2028, Mr. Bradley would have had 20 years of qualifying service and been eligible for $4,274.82 a month before taxes and insurance. "We had a plan," Mr. Bradley says to Azareth, as well as himself. She hacks a raw chicken in the kitchen and packs cornmeal into balls for Amiwo, a dish from her native Benin. It was in Benin, where Mr. Bradley was serving in the Peace Corps, that he met Arazis. He would spend hours traveling to see her on weekends. A few years later, Mr. Bradley's first paycheck from USAID went to a Beninese hospital to pay for the birth of their first child, James. When Mr. Bradley was assigned to a new project in Afghanistan and his young family couldn't come, he bought a house for them sight unseen in Minneapolis, where Ms. Bradley's new mother-in-law taught her how to ride the bus to her English classes with James slung on her back. She sighs. Adjusting to America alone with her baby, with her husband living abroad, was hard. But these past few months have been harder. When James graduated from college this spring, she wondered if it was okay to buy balloons since his dad had just lost his job. She wonders now if she could quit culinary school to find work herself, even though her goals, medium term, begin selling signature West African dishes locally, long term, own a restaurant in Minneapolis, remain tacked on the kitchen wall. They had thought when Mr. Bradley retired, he could help his wife open a restaurant and she could finally launch her own career after so many years of supporting his. But now Hawa was asking her mom if they would have to move again. She didn't know how to answer. The rumors and news reports became real for Mr. Bradley on February 4th when an email with the subject line, "The Path Forward," arrived in his inbox saying, "All USAID direct hire personnel will be placed on administrative leave globally, except for a few mission-critical employees." Later that week, Mr. Bradley watched on television as a man in a cherry picker pried the letters spelling U.S. Agency for International Development off the Ronald Reagan building in Washington. He remembers being surprised at how easily they came off. President John F. Kennedy created the agency during the Cold War in 1961 to compete with Soviet influence abroad. In the decades since, USAID grew into one of the largest aid organizations in the world, managing $77 billion in fiscal year 2024. Still, at the time of its gutting, it accounted for less than 1% of the U.S. government's budget and a smaller share of gross domestic product than what other leading industrialized nations spend on foreign aid. In those first weeks of February, as the agency was dismantled, protesters in Washington showed up to support what many saw as the pillar of American soft power. But the public outcry soon dwindled, even as the courts issued restraining orders and, in some cases, reversals. In late March, Mr. Bradley received a reduction in force email telling him his pay would stop July 1st. Mr. Bradley, along with more than 50 USAID colleagues, has filed a lawsuit alleging they were illegally terminated for political reasons. He has also joined more than 200 former USAID workers planning to file claims of age discrimination because the reduction in force will affect their retirement benefits. Yet even as he fights the government and feels deeply that it has broken its promises to him, Mr. Bradley also keeps thinking about other ways to serve. In particular, he wonders if running for office could allow him to keep his promise to protect the Constitution against any enemies, foreign or domestic. "My heart's really telling me to run," Mr. Bradley tells his family. "Somebody has to hold them to account." So, on a Saturday morning in late June, as an excessive heat warning blanketed Minneapolis, he found himself driving north on Interstate 94, hugging the Mississippi River in his yellow 1996 Ford F-250. He had spent the previous few weeks tackling projects around the house, such as replacing the brakes in his truck. He also did some things he never expected, such as reaching out to a local contact for the Democratic Party. When he spoke to Tamara Polzin about his interest in possibly running for office, she invited Mr. Bradley to come to a forum in Blaine for potential congressional candidates. He turns up the truck's radio dial as a public policy expert on NPR explains the importance of keeping federal workers based on their experience, not loyalty. Mr. Bradley turns the radio back down. After 17 years, he had experience, but hadn't he also been loyal? New administrations always bring new priorities and new marching orders, and he believed his job was to follow them like a soldier. A few years after President George W. Bush announced the military invasion of Afghanistan, Mr. Bradley was dispatched to Badakhshan province to manage a $57 million contract, helping locals find alternative crops to opium. At the end of President Barack's second term, he was sent to West Africa to help farmers in Guinea and Sierra Leone recover from the Ebola outbreak. Although he was disappointed when the first Trump administration cut that project's funding, he accepted it as part of the job. He had hoped Mr. Trump in his second term would see ways to use the organization for his own objectives, such as jump-starting job opportunities abroad so fewer foreigners would try to immigrate to America illegally. But even if Mr. Trump couldn't see value in USAID, Mr. Bradley believes other politicians, like Representative Tom Emmer, the GOP majority whip whose deep red district covers the northern and western outskirts of Minneapolis, should have. Walking into the Teamsters Union Hall, he finds Ms. Polzin taping names in the front of a wood dais for participants. As a local Democratic chair, Ms. Polzin has struggled in past cycles to find a single Democrat willing to run in the 6th District, one of the most Republican in the state. But now, more than a year and a half out from the 2026 midterms, she already has 13 interested candidates, including Mr. Bradley and five others, taking the stage today to practice speaking in front of a friendly audience. "The excitement in the district is more than I've ever seen," says Ms. Polzin. "People have been protesting every week," she says, angry about deportations and cuts to Veterans Affairs, despite Mr. Emmer's claims that the local VA has only dismissed seven probationary employees. "A new energy was injected into those protests," she adds, "after the recent shootings of two Democratic state lawmakers." Mr. Bradley takes a seat in the second row. "Are you running or watching?" a man behind him asks. "Just watching," Mr. Bradley answers. The event begins with a moment of silence for State Representative Melissa Hortman, who was killed, along with her husband, on June 14th in her home just 8 miles away. "We're going to forge ahead, and we're going to show that they can't deter us, and the best way to honor the memory of Melissa and Mark is to have the seeds of democracy sprouting up all throughout the 6th Congressional District," says State Representative Matt Norris, the event's moderator. Mr. Norris asks the five potential Democratic candidates questions about infrastructure, unions, science research, and Social Security. Throughout, Mr. Bradley takes notes on 3x5 index cards. He stays silent for the 90-minute event until the end, when one candidate, a flight attendant, talks about feeling an ethical compulsion to run for office. "That's right," he says quietly. "That's right." But a couple of days after the forum, that compulsion to run feels more like an impractical whim. For his family's sake, Mr. Bradley decides he probably needs to focus on finding a private sector job. He spends his last days as a USAID employee offering follow-up advice to the candidates who participated in Ms. Polzin's forum and speaking with a political action committee focused on supporting foreign assistance. He gets some satisfaction from picturing a diaspora and USAID employees fanning out around the world, bringing their expertise into the realm of politics and private companies. But at the same time, he can't help but think about what his country has lost. "We're an asset for the people of the United States," he says wistfully. "When we go out, it's from the American people." His wife still remembers when USAID came to her village. Seeing those American flags gave her, she stopped to ask Mr. Bradley the word for what happened to her arms. "Goosebumps," he says, and she nods. "They represent America doing good," she echoes, "that they are here to help." Now there's a couple of graphics here. The first one, I believe it's the first, let me double check. First one is a table that I'm going to have to zoom in a little bit here to see. It says, "Where does U.S. foreign aid flow?" And this is disbursements from foreign aid by country and region, fiscal year 2023. Europe and Eurasia, they had $16.619 billion went to Ukraine. And what would this be here? Middle East and North Africa, they got Israel, got $3.305 billion. These are dollars. Jordan got $1.716 billion. Egypt got $1.447 billion, and so on. We've got Afghanistan got $1.274 billion. Bangladesh got $552 million. Ethiopia got $1.774 billion. Somalia got $1.208 billion. Nigeria, $1.012 billion. There's a lot more to read here, but I'll go to the next graphic here. It's actually two parts. And it says, "The U.S. is the largest worldwide donor to humanitarian aid. Top donors to global humanitarian aid in 2024 by percentage, United States was 42%, European Commission 8%, Germany 7.9%, United Kingdom 6.1%, Sweden 3.8%, Japan 3.6%, and others is 28.6%. And the next one here, economic development support leads U.S. foreign aid. U.S. foreign aid by sector in billions of dollars fiscal year 2023. Economic development was $19.4 billion. Health was $16.1 billion, humanitarian assistance $15.6 billion, peace and security was $10.2 billion, multi-sector $2.9, program support $2.6, and goes all the way down to environment that has $1.4 billion. All right, well, we have a second cover story, and it has a title that is, "In Kenya, Humanitarian Workers Ponder Life After USAID," and this is written by Erica Page, who is a staff writer. And I don't see a paragraph that says why we wrote this, so I'll start reading. From Nairobi, Kenya, as self-described jaded New Yorker, Felicia never imagined working for the U.S. government. A nurse with a master's degree in international affairs and a long career, she had also spent nearly a decade with nonprofits across Africa focused on HIV, mostly at grassroots nonprofits. But it became clear to her that one agency was outpacing all the rest, especially when it came to public health. Its logo could be found in the most remote places, plastered on the walls of clinics and boxes of medical supplies. And it was funded by her home country. In 2021, she took a large pay cut to become a U.S. Foreign Service officer responsible for distributing American aid abroad. "Coming to work for USAID was the first thing that ever made me feel really proud to be an American," says Felicia, one of two USAID workers featured in this story who asked that only their first names be used because their severance packages have not yet been fully dispersed. In January, the Trump administration abruptly froze nearly all American foreign aid. Humanitarian programs around the world lurched to a halt. Felicia was fired. According to one estimate, 233,000 people, including 19,000 Americans, have lost their jobs with either USAID or its contractors. And for many Americans in particular, the transition is more than professional. It means rethinking their entire relationship to their homeland. "I'm ashamed of how my government has behaved," says Felicia. "This is not a job. This is my life's work." International moves are nothing new for Josh, who has spent the past 2 decades working with the Peace Corps and a variety of nonprofits. He has moved countries 8 times since 2001, mostly in Latin America. In July of last year, he started his first tour with USAID, bringing his wife and 2 daughters to Kenya. After he received his termination letter in March, Josh and his wife made the decision to move again. This time they're headed to a country that feels particularly foreign to all of them, the United States. "It's almost like I'm going on a Peace Corps service to my home country," he says. Josh doesn't know how that country will receive him. President Trump has said his work is useless and wasteful, and those around the president have called the workers like him and colleagues criminals and radical lunatics. Preparing to return to the Ohio town where he grew up, he tries to put himself in the shoes of his neighbors-to-be. He understands why Americans struggling with debt or working multiple jobs would cast doubt on the government sending billions of dollars in aid overseas each year. However, studies have consistently shown that Americans significantly overestimate foreign aid spending, believing on average it represents 26% of the federal budget when it actually makes up less than 1%. And Josh says he sees in foreign aid a fundamentally American spirit. "If I have a huge plate of food and you're sitting over there with a toothpick and a glass of water, I'm going to ask, 'Can I share my food with you?'" he says. While USAID's shuttering has left aid workers reeling, some argue that this could also be a learning moment for the sector, which has long been criticized for spending too much money on Western staff and imported supplies and too little on people in need. "Some pruning is not necessarily a bad thing," says Tracy Kajewski-Correa, director of the Pulte Institute for Global Development at University of Notre Dame. "If we as development professionals do a good job, we eventually put ourselves out of business," she says. Her own institute abruptly lost millions in funding, and she says they were forced to terminate 12 projects in 30 countries in a span of just 2 days, making it difficult to wind down their work responsibly. "It should have been a ramp down," she says. Felicia says one of the hardest things she had to do is close out projects with the grassroots charities that USAID had funded. She has found it heart-wrenching to tell her Kenyan counterparts that her government has decided it will no longer support their work. "Why would anyone ever trust us to do anything?" she asks. "Why would anyone want to work for us?" In Nairobi, the USAID shutdown has had a ripple effect. Home prices already falling in the city's upscale suburbs, normally in high demand among development professionals. For Felicia, the sudden departures of friends and colleagues is still hard to grasp. When she chose to work for the government, she knew she would have to implement policies with which she sometimes disagreed. "But nobody saw this coming, to be so disrespected and derided by her own government," she says. Now she wonders what she will do next. The job market has been flooded with laid-off USAID workers like her. She says the last job she applied for sent a rejection note explaining that it had received over 1,000 applications. As Felicia continues her search, she has begun volunteering twice a week at a small health clinic in Nairobi. She says it helps her maintain a sense of purpose as she ponders the future. But one thing is clear, Felicia is not going back to the United States. She will stay here, she says, and continue the work her government once did. Now, there's a graphic here, and it says, what does USAID pay for? And here are selected projects funded by the agency. And it's a map of the world, and they got 6 points. So, Washington, D.C., the Famine Early Warning Systems Network, which forecasts food shortages to prevent and manage crises around the world. In Colombia, programs to help farmers transition from cocoa, the base of cocaine, to other crops. In Ukraine, repairs to grain elevators damaged in a Russian invasion and other support for farmers in one of the world's major staple crop suppliers. South Africa. Nearly 20% of the country's HIV response helping support 8.5 million HIV positive people. In Afghanistan, the American University of Afghanistan's university prep program for schools who could not finish high school under the Taliban rule. And in Sudan, grassroots aid groups called emergency response rooms, which operate in areas too dangerous for bigger organizations to reach. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sunsounds of Arizona. Okay, like I mentioned at the top of the show, points to progress is AWOL, so I'll read Progress Watch. Go Fish. How removing old New England dams is opening rivers to new wildlife. This is written by Cameron Pooh, who is a staff writer. And they do have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. One main town, built on water-powered mills during the Industrial Revolution, is joining a quiet revolution that's clearing the path for healthier New England rivers. From Yarmouth and Vesey, Maine, the silvery water of the Royal River glistens as sunlight strikes its surface on an overcast afternoon. The modest waterway flows an easy 39 miles from southern Maine's Sabbath Day Lake to the Atlantic coast at Casco Bay, attracting kayakers, paddleboarders, and great blue heron. But to Landis Hudson, a Yarmouth resident who describes herself as a bit of a river therapist, the Royal is no idyllic symbol of a bucolic New England. It's a broken, flagging ecosystem, mainly due to two dams, the Bridge Street and East Elm Street dams, that block migratory fish from their natural habitat. That may be about to change. Ms. Hudson, who runs the environmental nonprofit Maine Rivers, believes the Royal can be part of New England's recent river revolution, the removal of thousands of small dams, once used to power mills during the Industrial Revolution, that have clogged local waterways for over 250 years. Despite the Trump administration's reversals of eco-friendly protections, she and other environmental stewards say that they see a path to healthier New England rivers. When I look out at the water, I see something that is not really alive, says Karen Orenstein, a Yarmouth town councilor who has pushed to remove the Royal's dams. I'm imagining a river that is more oxygenated, has the return of fish to it, and has all kinds of other animals. New England is the most densely dammed region in the United States with over 14,000 dams. Rivers here are small, and it's rare for dams to reach higher than 40 feet, says Andy Fisk, Northeast Regional Director at American Rivers, an environmental nonprofit. That may be minuscule compared with the West's grand hydroelectric plants, which can tower thousands of feet into the air. But it's all the same to fish, which can no more cross a 40-foot-high dam than a 400-foot one. Damming even small waterways has an outsized environmental impact. So does removing the structures, which are ubiquitous in New England's roughly 19,000 miles of rivers and streams. A relatively small stream that you could wade across, Mr. Fisk says, if unblocked, can support breeding journeys for tens of thousands of migratory fish. After a decade, a council votes. New Englanders seem to be waking up to that reality. Between 2010 and 2024, at least 170 dams were removed in this region, according to data from American Rivers. It's more than double the number of removals during the most of the preceding century. Yarmouth jumped on that trend in January when, after more than a decade of debate, its town council voted unanimously to remove the Bridge Street and East Elm Street dams. The move is predicted to provide habitat for 35,000 alewives, a type of river herring common in Maine but now largely missing from the Royal. Multiple reports from the University of Southern Maine, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, an environmental consultant, and conservation nonprofits have concluded that the dams have significantly reduced the number of fish in the river. Yarmouth has plenty of models to follow. One such guide star has been the removal of the Vesey and Great Works dams on Maine's Penobscot River. That project, which brought millions of fish back to some 2,000 miles of habitat has been hailed as a huge success. But removing one dam, not to mention two, is time-consuming and expensive. And in Yarmouth, like much of the region, many people see the dams as cherished pieces of local history. Still, to Yarmouth's leadership and many residents, the trade-offs of removing the dams will be worth it if it means a healthier river, a sentiment shared by a growing number of communities throughout the region. You can have some variation of this conversation on every river going up the coast of Maine, Ms. Hudson says. On every river, there's somebody paying attention to the barriers, and there's some group of people trying to improve the situation. The challenges of change. Although this small, affluent Portland suburb is now mostly known for its annual clam festival, Yarmouth was once a thriving hub of manufacturing. The Bridge Street and East Elm Street dams, both built in the late 1800s, powered a textile mill and a shoe factory, respectively. That history is part of why Alan Dugas, who owns and operates a boatyard in Yarmouth Marina, hopes the dams stay. He says his grandmother, who immigrated to Yarmouth from Canada, worked in the Bridge Street textile mill. Like his grandmother, Mr. Dugas depends on the river for his livelihood. He and other business owners worry that removing the dams could release toxins and excess sediment into the marina, requiring the local boatyards to pursue time-intensive and costly remedies. When we have issues with dam removal, we're not trying to be difficult, says Deborah Delp, another boatyard owner. We just have a lot of challenges. Last year, the Army Corps of Engineers concluded that the project posed little to no long-term risk of contaminating the marina or increasing sedimentation. Earlier reports from other groups also failed to detect high levels of toxins. Support for businesses and other costs. Despite the low risk of contamination, Yarmouth plans to help the boatyard's efforts to obtain and finance insurance to protect them financially should those analyses prove incorrect, according to the town's resolution on removal. The cost for the Yarmouth project may reach as high as $5.7 million, according to the Army Corps of Engineers study. Should it move forward, the town would foot at least 15% of the bill, estimated as high as $860,000. Yarmouth's resolution stipulates that no taxpayer money can be used to fund the removal, meaning the town would need government grants or private funds. Dam removals also keep with another local tradition that differs from the one Mr. Dugas holds dear. Maine has a rich history of innovative water reforms. The 1999 removal of the Edwards Dam near the state capital of Augusta set the stage for subsequent dam removals elsewhere. And it was pollution in southern Maine's Androscoggin River that in 1972 inspired the Clean Water Act, a landmark law that still governs waterways today. Many Yarmouth residents seem eager to continue that clean water advocacy. More than three-quarters of over 100 public comments selected by the town during its study of removal plans were supportive. The river, Ms. Ornstein says, is the heart of our town. Farther north, the Penobscot River shows what a successful dam removal looks like. Standing in Riverside Park in Vasey, Maine, Cody Dillingham points across the river to a boulder painted with white and red graffiti. The embellishment marks what used to be the eastern end of the Vasey Dam, says Mr. Dillingham, a fisheries biologist with the Penobscot Nation, an indigenous tribe. That dam was removed in 2013 as part of the Penobscot River Restoration Project, or the PRRP, which brought together over a dozen nonprofits, government agencies, and the Penobscot Nation to boost fish passage in the river. The group also removed the Great Works Dam upriver from Vasey in 2012 and installed a fish passage channel at a third in 2016. The PRRP took well over a decade to come to fruition, but the number of alewives migrating in the Penobscot jumped from 222 in 2010 to nearly 5.7 million in 2024, according to the Maine Department of Marine Resources. The river is a living, breathing entity with rights, says Chuck Loring, director of the tribe's Department of Natural Resources and a Penobscot Nation citizen. It's just really important to tribal folks that the connection is improving. A model for consideration. Some species, such as salmon, have been slower to recover because of other dam blockages and environmental pressures, including a warming climate. Still, Penobscot serves as a beacon of hope for river restorers. In California, the group that undertook the largest dam removal in U.S. history, the Klamath River, modeled itself after the Maine Alliance. "We have turned the corner on the Penobscot River," says Dan McCaw, another Penobscot Nation fisheries biologist. If people really prioritize healthy rivers, clean water, and robust fish runs, dam removal is by far the best way to accomplish that. Back in Yarmouth, Mike Brandimarte strolls along a fishway at the Bridge Street Dam, where he uses a GoPro camera to check for fish. Today, he doesn't see many, but he's optimistic he'll see more when the dams come out. An engineer, he admires the human ingenuity that went into building the dams. "But times have changed," he says. "We're at a point where it's time to give things back a little, too." Like I mentioned at the top of the show, the science and nature section is also AWOL, so I'll read the explainer. And it's entitled, "How Intertwined Are U.S. Colleges and Federal Funding?" They do have this, why we wrote this paragraph here. It says, "As universities and the Trump administration battle over federal funding, questions arise about the obligations around grants and other financial arrangements, and what's at stake if those systems falter." This is written by Ira Porter, who is a staff writer. If you've ever gotten a Pell Grant to pay for college, or a federal student loan, or completed work study, the government probably paid for it. Higher education and the federal government have been intertwined to the point that college would look much different if they were not. What is not always clear is what rules govern those relationships, which have existed for more than a century. These institutions that are very largely funded by the federal government do have a responsibility to deliver. And I think, quite honestly, we're sort of re-examining what that means right now, says Beth Eckers, an economist and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank. On July 21st, oral arguments were heard in a pivotal case concerning Harvard University and the Trump administration over more than $2 billion in federal funding cuts over an ideological clash. As of publication time, the judge has not made a ruling. However the judge rules, President Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill is already starting to change the system. It alters student loans that low-income and middle-class families rely on to pay for college, and it puts caps on how much students can borrow for law and medical schools. The new tax bill also aims to hold schools and programs accountable, including by tying federal money to earnings outcomes of graduates. For a long time, we celebrated institutions as this golden ticket to the American dream, and as long as they kind of looked like they were doing that, that they were protecting civil rights, very roughly speaking, we let them go, Dr. Eckers said. But I think there is a new call to institutions to deliver for what they receive, which is all this funding from taxpayers. The president's proposed budget, which has not yet been voted on, also includes major cuts to research and federal student aid. This and other recent actions by the administrations highlights the depth and demands of these long-standing agreements. Now, what follows is a question and answer piece. Question: in how many areas do colleges and universities converge financially? Answer: arrangements between the government and higher education have existed for decades. The Morrill Land Grant Acts of 1862 and 1890, for example, created land grant colleges in states from the sale of federally owned land. Today, a variety of government agencies offer grants to colleges and universities. The U.S. Department of Education gives grants that help with the operation of college sports, for example. And science grants are regularly given to colleges and universities from a range of agencies, including the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. More private and public nonprofit colleges are tax-exempt and do not pay income taxes, including on revenue from athletic events. Many are also exempt from property taxes. but colleges and universities are responsible for payroll taxes. They also pay taxes on endowments, which Mr. Trump's recent tax bill increased for some schools. Question: what are the biggest intersections of the federal government and higher education? Answer: one of the most significant ways the federal government funds higher education today is through student loans. Federal student aid can be traced back to the 1965 Higher Education Act, which called for financial assistance to college students via loans, scholarships, grants, and work studies under the bill's Title IV. It ends up being this really complex system where the federal government helps facilitate students to afford college through a number of different programs, says John Cheslock, a professor at Penn State University, who studies the way colleges and universities are funded. The U.S. budgeted $1.35 billion for federal student aid to colleges for fiscal year 2025, which ends September 30th. That figure includes $39 billion for the Pell Grant, around $1.25 billion for work-study, and more than $93 billion for loans. Budget proposals for the next fiscal year include decreasing to federal work-study, down $980 million, and would require schools to pay for 75% of associated costs. In addition, the recent tax bill significantly changes the student loan program and consolidates multiple programs into two. The Department of Education said the bill is simplifying the student loan repayment system in a statement on July 18th when it announced that implementation has begun. The bill also eliminates the graduate PLUS or PLUS loan program and caps graduate loan borrowing to $20,500 a year or a lifetime total of $100,000. It also limits loans for professional schools to $50,000 a year or a $200,000 lifetime total. It caps Parent PLUS loans at $65,000 per individual or $25,000 annually. Besides being involved in student loans, the government, through the Higher Education Act, also gives money for historically black colleges and universities, minority-serving educational institutions, and tribal colleges. The support is aimed at funding institutions with a higher number of low-income students. These schools saw a bump during the Biden administration, but cuts have been proposed for them. Another major area of federal funding is research, with some $60 billion currently set aside for that purpose. The NIH receives the largest share at $48 billion, while the National Science Foundation receives almost $10 billion. While the NIH funds research related to health, at least 20 other government agencies also fund research at a rate of hundreds of millions to billions of dollars annually, including the Department of Energy, Defense, Agriculture, and Veterans Affairs. Unlike federal student aid, Dr. Cheslock says, research dollars are more concentrated. You can think of the research bucket as being especially important for the most advantaged institutions, he says. Most, if not all, of the schools that get the bulk of that money have strong doctoral programs and are recognized as practicing the highest level of research. Harvard, Columbia, and Mr. Trump's alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, all Ivy League schools have dominated headlines because they get large chunks of federally funded research dollars. Question: how do colleges and universities qualify for funding? Answer: the baseline for any college or university receiving federal funding is that it must be accredited by a recognized regional or national accrediting agency. Accrediting agencies, which are non-governmental, verify that schools meet quality standards and are in good financial standing. To receive money for federal student aid, schools must sign participation agreements acknowledging that they have to comply with Title IV. Students must meet guidelines for federal money, which schools must return if students withdraw. And colleges and universities are regularly audited for financial stability. Except for those schools that forego Title IV funding because they don't want to comply with certain federal policies, which is a small number of institutions, federal funding affects all of them, Dr. Cheslock says. Schools must also adhere to the Clery Act, which requires them to collect and report campus crime statistics. And as part of complying with Title IX, a civil rights law, schools can't discriminate based on sex in any programming or activities such as athletics. The fact that dozens of schools closed last year and that more are in danger of closing is a sign that accreditation is broken, Dr. Ackers says. Another sign she sees is that students aren't earning decent salaries but are saddled with debt. She suggests that there is a need for more accreditors, something the Trump administration is working on. And the final question, what is owed to the government for federal funding? And the final answer, schools receiving research money have compliance guidelines. That money is issued to institutions which supervise the spending by researchers, says Harold Varmus, a Nobel Prize-winning scientist and former NIH director under President Bill Clinton. The money pays for salaries, training of graduate students or postdoctoral fellows, and equipment. A portion of the grant money, called indirect costs, goes toward facility maintenance and is calculated by auditors during a thorough process, according to Dr. Varmus. Grants are typically 3 to 5 years. It's a highly regulated process that is not casual at all, and the idea that there's a lot of waste and abuse in this process is completely ridiculous, Dr. Varmus says. Grant money is paid out annually, he says, but a multi-year grant's remaining balance is included in every new budget. The expectation is that grantees report how the money was spent, publish research findings in scientific journals, and make the findings available to the public, and host regular meetings to update individual agencies on their work. It is extremely rare for grants to abruptly end or be canceled, he says. Under the 1974 Impoundment Control Act, the administration has 3 options, says Søren Lindgren Savage, a lawyer at Protect Democracy. It can delay spending after sending very detailed reasons to Congress, get Congress to rescind funding, which recently happened with $9 billion in cuts to foreign aid and PBS and NPR, or spend the money. None of the legal options, Ms. Lindgren Savage says, are that you can just sit on the money as long as you like. I'm going to skip the home forum because I might not be able to get it all in the next less than 5 minutes, so I'll go to the monitor's view. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are 2 of them, and here's the first one. For Gaza, spiritual diplomacy. Since the Hamas attack in Israel nearly 2 years ago, the Central Asian nation of Kazakhstan has reacted like many other mainly Muslim countries. It condemned the attack. It rejected plans by Israel to displace Gaza's Palestinians. It called for a ceasefire as well as unimpeded delivery of humanitarian aid, and it sent aid itself to relieve hunger. But Kazakhstan has been doing something beyond moral declarations and moral actions, and not just for the Israel-Hamas war. It has deployed what it calls spiritual diplomacy to help quell faith-driven conflicts at their roots by reversing hatred with the recognition of the divine dignity in each person. Located in the middle of Eurasia, Kazakhstan has been a crossroads for major faiths over centuries. Since 2003, it has hosted a conference every 3 years that brings together prominent world clergy, from the Pope to respected Muslim imams. The next one starts in September. These gatherings, called the Congress of Leaders of World and Traditional Religions, elevate faith leaders as an alternative to political leaders in dealing with conflicts. It's critically important for spiritual leaders to weigh in and demonstrate through their example that dialogue and respect towards others must play a larger role in international relations, Bulat Sarsenbayev, deputy head of the Congress Secretariat, told Asia Times. Spiritual leaders who truly represent a culture of peace are powerful voices in today's world. Kazakhstan is not alone in promoting interfaith dialogue at a time of Israeli-Palestinian tensions. In early July, Israeli President Isaac Herzog met with the delegation of European imams who prayed together for the Israel hostages in Gaza. In March, an interfaith march of Jews, Christians, and Muslims took place in Jerusalem. Don't let people tell you that there can be no peace and that Israelis and Palestinians are forever doomed to be hostile to each other. German Ambassador Stefan Seibert told the Times of Israel during the peace walk. Also in March, religious leaders representing Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and the Druze faith met in Jerusalem for an evening of dialogue. Perhaps it is time for people of faith to step forward. We can rise above crisis to say, "You are not my enemy," even if we deeply disagree, Rabbi Daniel Rowe told the Jewish press. We must foster voices that recognize the divine image in one another and acknowledge that we all serve and pray to the same God. And the next Monitor's View article is entitled, Hints of Compromise in Congress. Among the many polarizing issues in the United States, illegal immigration ranks high. The current administration's measures have cut apprehensions and unlawful border crossings to their lowest points in decades. But its sweeping crackdown of unauthorized migrants, including cases of wrongful or mistaken detention and deportation, has severely divided the public and elected representatives. Still, a significant handful of congressional members are seeking to bridge this schism, and several others are pushing to expand the appeal of cooperation and compromise across party lines. A coalition of 11 House Republicans and 12 Democrats has signed on to a bill, the Dignity Act of 2025, which reflects several compromises. The bill takes off the table citizenship for people who have lived long in the U.S. illegally, yet allows for legal residency after 7 years, with related check-ins and fees. It also updates asylum and other legal immigration processes. This style of bipartisanship received a boost in June. The House Civility and Respect Caucus proposed a resolution to allow two legislators from opposing parties to be sponsors of a bill. The current rule allows only one lawmaker. While this change may seem minor, it can encourage willingness to work across party lines and signal seriousness of intent to voters back home. And I am going to have to truncate that article because by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.